Hello, everybody. This is David Bixenspan with episode 2 of The Trademarks. I am joined by my co-host Dylan Hales, as this week we are doing this instead of The Bix Show, because we had a few things come up that we definitely wanted to talk about in the that fit into the wheelhouse of The Trademarks. So, Dylan, what is up in the world of wrestling and IP this week that we are going to talk about?
Well, we've got several things that are on the docket. Of course, for those who didn't listen to episode 1, Trademark, shame on you. It's available at davidbix.com. It's also available at voiceswrestling.com, so it's easy to track down if you're looking for it. In that episode, we covered sort of previous litigation surrounding WrestleMania weekend involving vendors selling, trademarked and WWE likeness items and things of that nature. We're going to do a little bit of follow-up on that. We're also going to do a little bit of a follow-up on sort of the business model of WWE and Live coming on the heels both of Mania weekend and the debacle that happened, I suppose, this weekend with their shows. Then we're going to go into a discussion of some of the issues surrounding pro wrestling tees and the WWE, and sort of it's an interesting issue there that I don't want to get to just yet, but that's kind of a multifaceted issue that puts pro wrestling tees on both sides of the IP issue, I think. And then we will round up with a talk of the Gilbert lawsuit. The Gilbert family lawsuit against the WWE and some other things of that nature. Did I miss anything in there, Vince?
Not really. I mean, there was something actually I forgot to add, but I just added it now. It's another update. So I guess we'll start with, you know what, actually, why don't we start with this one instead than the one I just added, which was that this was actually several weeks. Actually, no, I think they followed up on it too within the last week or two. That Family Wrestling Entertainment, first they canceled all of their upstate New York shows, I think a week or two after we did the first show, and then I think now they may have even canceled their other show. What exactly was it that happened?
Well, they definitely canceled a couple of the shows, which I don't think the shows, I'm not mistaken, the shows they canceled were more theoretical shows in the sense I don't know that they had announced cards yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even remember if they put tickets on sale yet, but in any event, they canceled the dates. And then I don't know, actually, you'd know probably better than me whether or not they canceled the other show. But the real point here is that this, of course, for those who didn't listen to episode 1, this was the show that the company we talked about.
The critically acclaimed episode 1.
That's right, very critically acclaimed. This was the pro wrestling company, independent group, that Mike Johnson of PW Insider had written a column about, sort of using them as an example of what happens, the consequences of internet piracy for small, I'll just use the term mom and pop, wrestling outfits and enterprises. And he sort of pointed to FWE as, they're potentially going out of business, which, by the way, when he wrote the column, there was no reason to believe they were going out of business.
No.
which makes you wonder if he hadn't been told something more explicit ahead of time. But, the whole point of the column, which we discussed at length on that show, was basically that, you know, when you pirate stuff, you're screwing over the little guy. I think that's probably the best way to sort of characterize what Mike was trying to get across in that piece. And, whatever has happened since then, the point is that it looks like there is a possibility that FWE actually is going out of business. So,
yes.
What are your thoughts on this?
And by the way, I mean, just one other thing for people who didn't listen, part of the reason FWE sort of got the spotlight with this was also that the piracy seemed especially egregious because of how quickly, videos of the main event were going up, and also that people were posting links on their Facebook. But anyway,
yes,
I'm just looking at their Facebook right now, by the way, so that was a couple days ago. They refunded all the upstate New York shows. I mean, I don't know if there's that much more to touch on other than just really giving the update, because, and we covered this pretty in depth, it was the type of promotion that you could tell they were maybe not necessarily making money on the live show. And maybe running upstate would change that because they seem to be more receptive to that type of to the type of show FWE runs. Because, you know, Mike O'Brien's been so successful with his Northeast Wrestling cards there that if you promote well, and maybe it's just Northeast Wrestling that knows how to do it the right way, I could see how those could have done well. I don't actually know who their local promoter was, but I could see why they tried to do that. But whatever happened with them splitting from this guy happened. Actually, we have an explanation, further explanation from March 30th. Wait, was this before or after we, when did we, when was that first show?
Don't ask me that.
Okay, I have to look back. Give me 1 second. Because it was from March 30th. And
It was right before Mania Weekend.
Oh, yeah. We did it right before Mania Weekend. So, yeah, this would have been right at, like, the week after we did the first show. So, they're saying it was the venues that, I guess, were co-promoting and helping with the expenses. So let me see what we have from March 30th. In the shitty news department, due to the failure of the venue co-promoter, I use that term loosely, upstate to live up to the terms of the agreement, all three upstate shows had to be canceled. Those of you in the upstate area probably know exactly who we're talking about. Wait, is he saying it's Mike O'Brien? No. It must be someone in the venue then. Where was I? Probably know who we're talking about. We were hired to run three shows in the upstate market with the venue agreeing to cover certain expenses. They missed their payment deadline and bounced multiple payments to talent, only to come back with a million different excuses. We did everything we could to try to keep the dates and even considered moving the shows back to Brooklyn. Wait, weren't these on three back-to-back days?
I believe so, yes.
So they were going to run three back-to-back nights in Brooklyn?
Well, this is, I mean, this is a promotion that booked a West Coast show and then moved it to the East Coast.
Well, they booked a West Coast show for no apparent reason. I don't understand how that happened in the first place.
Well, I don't understand a lot about this company or this model, but I think it is, you know, I don't want to spend too much time on this because we have a lot of other stuff to cover and we have limited time.
And in the grand scheme of things, it's not that important.
I do just want to say that I think it is, I think it is telling that this company is now blaming yet again somebody else for potential business failure and not themselves. Look, it may very well be that they got screwed. I don't know. I mean, that could be the case. But I just, you know, look, this is, I think as we are more and more removed from this and, you know, the original Mike Johnson piece, and as we learn more about this company and the things that have gone on with it and some of the promotional decisions that have been made and some of the things that have fallen through, I think it's becoming increasingly more likely that this is a case of a company that maybe just isn't run very well. And, you know, which is sort of the position we staked out to one degree or another on that first episode, is that maybe this is a company that the business model is an issue. Not so much the, not that piracy is helping her, you know, but right. that is not the primary culprit when discussing the woes of this company.
Right. I mean, and as we discussed the first time, sorry, by all accounts, they'd been treating the wrestlers well and paying on time and stuff. So, you know what? It could be one of those things where they just didn't have a good business model, but they were honest promoters as far as dealing with the wrestlers and stuff. And so actually spending the money screwed them.
Well, you know, I'm going to take this opportunity to segue because when we talk about business models in independent wrestling groups, Dave.
Yes. Because there's really not much more to say about that. Yeah, so WWN Live, who we talked about a lot on that first show, this weekend they ran two Evolve shows. And, well, this was also coming off of WrestleMania weekend where you had not realized that they charge extra if you buy the day of.
I can't even explain why I didn't realize that because we discussed it on the show and I think I've encountered the problem before, but for some reason, I think what struck me was the totality of the problem, particularly as it pertained to WrestleMania weekend.
Well, right.
WWN Live was running, what, 6 or 7 shows, if you count Kaiju Big Battle and Shimmer. You know, they ran, let's see.
Two nights of Kingdom and WWN Super Show, two nights of King of Indies, Shimmer, two Evolve shows, Kaiju Big Battle. So that's seven.
Yeah.
And what? What was the last one you said?
That's seven shows, right?
Yeah, that's seven. Oh, that is seven shows. Okay, you said Kaiju at the same time.
Yeah, so I mean, here's the issue. Like, they did not, first of all, my first problem with that is they didn't offer a package deal. Because
right.
I would have purchased a package deal, and I think a lot of people would have. And there were clever and interesting ways they could have even marketed a package deal, if they had wanted to make them look competitive, vis-a-vis the WWE Network. Or New Japan World, or whoever they see as a competitor, if they even see these people as competitors.
Right, depending on how it was priced, I probably would have bought it too. In the end, I only bought Shimmer, partially because I was angry about when a show would come and I forgotten to buy it the day before, and I'm like, oh, screw that, you know. At Shimmer though, yeah. I think Shimmer did have the Impulse Buy Punishment, but I decided to still get it. But they were the only one that bundled the video on demand into their only price, as opposed to having the separate pricing like they usually have.
Yeah, I mean, what was fascinating to me about the whole deal is you've got these seven shows over the course of a couple of days, and, well, I guess 3 days, because the first of all show was on Thursday. But you've got these seven shows over the course of 3 days,
mm-hmm.
and the obvious opportunity for a bundle is there, which they don't do. But then there's... like, not only on top of that, the issue with raising the price, because for those who don't know, you know, it's $9.95 if you just want the live stream, and then it's $14.95 if you want the live stream plus the VOD, and then it's $19.95 if you want the live stream plus the VOD and you order it the same day. So you're punished for ordering
well,
the same
and
day.
It's $14.95 if you want just the live stream but buy it on the same day.
On the same day, correct.
Yeah.
So there's a $5 penalty no matter what you do on the same day. Now, here's the part that I think is so mind-blowing. They had things that were occurring on these shows that may have dictated secondary purchases. Like, for example, you have a tournament called King of the Indies. It's a two-night tournament. Somebody may have looked at the results of the first night and said, you know what, I really want to get the second show. But by then, it's too late, and you incur the $5 penalty, and then there's no point in getting it because you can wait until after and get the VOD. I mean, it's so stupid.
And the Evolve and Dragon Gate USA unification match.
Absolutely. I mean, the situation with the booking exacerbated the stupidity of the business model. It actually made it even more obviously dumb. And on top of all that, the video on demand stuff, the VOD didn't even go up until basically after Mania weekend was already over. I can't remember when the first VOD went up, but I think it was late in the weekend, maybe even on Sunday. You know, as Mania is getting ready to start, is when the first VODs went up. And it's like, I mean, so in other words, if you paid for video on demand, maybe operating under the principle that this is a late West Coast time and you can't watch it in real time, which is another issue with this, is that a lot of people couldn't watch the live feed because they had work or whatever the case, they didn't want to stay up all night to watch. You're still punished because the VODs were not going up in a timely fashion.
Yep.
I mean, it was just a complete series of absolutely ridiculous things. Every single bad aspect of that business model was highlighted and magnified by 500 over WrestleMania weekend, which in theory should have been the biggest time for this company, especially when you consider the fact that Ring of Honor did not do an iPay-per-view for their show, so they had no real competitor. And WrestleCon didn't do an iPay-per-view either.
Mm-hmm.
They were the only game in town when it came to iPay-per-view, and they completely botched and bungled the whole operation. I did order two of the shows. I ordered King of the Indies Night 2, which I was very pleased with. It was a good show. And I ordered the WWE Super Show, which I did not think was a great show, but had at least one really great match, so I was ultimately fine with my purchase. But, again, if they had offered a package, like all seven shows for 50 or 60 or, hell, maybe even $70, I probably would, with VOD, of course, I probably would have purchased the entire package, and I think there's a very substantial number of people who would have.
Mm-hmm.
I think they left a lot of money on the table by doing it the way they did it.
Well, especially because even though, I mean, it was like the case last year too, but you have all these people who used to be spending $70 for WrestleMania that are not now.
Yep. They're used to burning the money, you know. And
for the one pay-per-view
and,
each
you know,
year, yeah.
Yeah, I like it's just it to me it's a mind-blowing decision. I mean, to me, because the market is, I think I probably would have charged $50 or $60 for all 7 shows, and I think they would have made a ton more money than they ended up making on the show. Now, to be fair, we don't know what they made,
right?
But and I hope they did well. I don't want them to do poorly, but realistically, you know, I can't imagine that they did nearly as well as they could have. And then they follow it up with the shows this past weekend, which, you know, had a different problem. The problems with the show this past weekend were, particularly the second night, stream issues. You know, the dreaded iPay-per-view doesn't work phenomenon that has really screwed ROH more than anybody else, really. But it reared its head yet again. I thought we had kind of gotten past that with WWE and Live, because the Mania shows I thought went on very well. At least I didn't have any real problems with them. But, you know, the same exact thing. And also the VOD issue, because there were people who ordered the first night show on VOD and wanted to watch it before they watched the second night show, but it still wasn't up yet. So they couldn't watch it spoiler free, you know. And
well,
I mean,
that's a problem, just, though, that they should not allow, if the show is not up after the fact, they should not allow you to, like, they should be allowed to order it as part of, if you're buying part of the package, but you shouldn't be able to order VOD only if it's not there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's completely insane. I mean, like, this model is a very alienating model. And what was going on Saturday in particular, which is when the real profits were, is, you know, we had people, you know, followers of ours on Twitter and even friends of ours who were, you know, had ordered the show, and also people who were in the building there. I believe it was in Orlando that night. And, you know, they first of all, the problem started at the beginning of the show because the feed didn't work right out of the gate. So, you know, they were scrambling desperately. It took several minutes longer than it was supposed to for the original feed to work on the front end of the show. And there was lots of hiccups and other sort of intermittent problems. It seemed like it was working okay from a while from the live reports that I was getting as I was sort of following along on Twitter and talking to other people. And then it completely went out again. And I don't know, like, now keep in mind, you know, if you're somebody who's just ordered this and doesn't have a Twitter account, you may not even know what the hell's going on, because I don't know that what the deal is with WWE in support. But
well, we did get an email screenshot from a Free Pro Wrestling.
Certainly there were some emails going on, sure. But I don't think, you know, it's not like it's a different dynamic than when your cable goes out and it's obvious
right.
That your cable's gone out. You don't know necessarily what the hell is going on.
Well,
so
also, I have a question with Twitter. I'm sorry, should I go ahead or do you want to keep going?
No, go ahead.
Okay, because I don't think I follow the main WWN account, but correct me if I'm wrong. If there's messages about the status of the stream, aren't those usually on Gabe's account?
The majority of the ones I saw were on Gabe's account.
So you could
be
following. Yeah.
People follow Gabe.
Right. So I don't know if they would actually be on the WWN Live account. So if you would have to be following Gabe, I'll go look as we keep talking about this, but that's part of the problem too. So anyway, when people emailed support, some of them did get answers. The reply that we saw was, the show was stopped. We are in intermission. We won't start till we are back online shortly.
Which is a remarkable statement, because to me it implies that they don't want to give a refund. And I'm not saying that they didn't, because eventually Gabe did send out a tweet where he said that they were going to make good of people. But, you know, to put a show on hold, I mean, first of all...
There are no tweets at all on the WWN Live Twitter account, which has... This account appears to be completely dead. Wait, let me go back. Let's see. They have... At WWN Live has 0 tweets, 0 following... 1 followers, no lists. I'm going to follow them for now. Is there an Evolve account?
This is some live action sleuthing we have here.
I don't think there is an Evolve account, is there?
No, maybe everything goes through Gabe, but the point is it presumes that people know that.
Well, yeah, that was the point, yes.
And the real issue is, to me at least, the real issue is, think about your situation as a consumer. I mean, if you're somebody who ordered the stream, you don't know what the hell is going on unless you're on Twitter or you've made an email. You don't know if it's something wrong with your streaming device. You don't know if your Wi-Fi has gone to shit necessarily. Well, you probably can easily check that. But the point is, it could be any number of issues. And you don't know. Most importantly, you don't know when the show is going to come back up unless you go and research it. And they're not telling you it's going to be 5 minutes, it's going to be 10. They're saying the show has been stopped. You know, and on top of it, imagine you're somebody in the building. You know, our friend Tim Evans, who's follows both of us on Twitter, he was in the building, and he's sitting there waiting for an hour for the show to resume because they don't know what the hell to do because they've lost all these people who are watching on the iPay-per-view stream, and they don't, you know, presumably they don't want to, you know, give refunds, and they don't really know how long things are going to be, and, you know, I can't imagine sitting there in Orlando, Florida, in what was probably a hot room this time of year, for an indeterminate length of time, just fiddling my thumbs, wondering when this wrestling show I paid to go to is going to continue. You know, it's just bad business. It's just bad business, you know, and I understand that there are going to be mistakes and problems and hiccups along the way when you're dealing with what is, in theory, a newer technology, but this isn't a brand new technology. Right. I feel like a lot of these hiccups should have been worked out by now. I don't know. I want to be sympathetic to anybody who's, you know, trying to do their own thing and isn't part of a major institution of WWE size, but they make it really, really hard at times, stuff like this. It just comes off as really Bush League.
Yeah, and what the heck did... Oh, I went to the WWN Live website to see what Twitter they linked to, if any, and of course the music on that stupid auto-loading video starts playing. their about page. Okay, so I don't think they have an official Twitter account. So when I googled Evolve Wrestling Twitter, the first result was for an Evolve Twitter roleplay account. Oh, this actually has not had any tweets since right after it at least attempted to start in January of last year. It says official Evolve. Well, first of all, their name is at Evolve Restin, WRESTINRP for roleplay. Official Evolve Wrestling shows Tuesday Evolve, Friday AWE. # the best never quits, # join the family. So then the second Google result was for Gabe's account, which does say in the description, although it says, you know, it has his name as Gabe Sapolsky, at Book Gabe, official Twitter of WWN Live family, including DGUSA, Evolve, Shine, and the only Twitter of Gabe Sapolsky, WWNLive.com for IPBV. So yes, you have to know to follow Gabe.
Which, to be fair, probably the majority of people know that. But the point is, if you're trying, let's operate under the assumption that you're actually trying to build your business, okay?
Hypothetically.
If you're trying to build your business, like let's say somebody was on the F4WOnline.com website and they read the daily update one day pinned by one David Bixenspan, which had a link in the bottom, or had something in the bottom about the upcoming Evolve card, and they've never watched an Evolve show before. They're probably not going to know that they need to follow Gabe to answer technical issues to get any sort of insight into that. I mean, like, I suppose you could argue that we're making too much of this, but the point is, in isolation, I think it would be kind of ridiculous to belabor this point. But when you look at the other things, particularly the stuff that happened over Mania Weekend, the failure to get the VOD up in a timely fashion, you're looking at, I think, a systemic problem with the delivery of their product, which is a shame. Because some of my favorite wrestling talent on earth is largely operates as a home base out of the WWN Live umbrella, and I'm going to continue to support them, but you know I'm not going to support them as much as I would like to, or because I refuse to take risk on this company, and I don't think that they've set up a system that rewards people who are loyal followers of their product. Because what benefit do I have? Like this weekend, let's say I wanted to order both of those shows. You know, did I get any break on ordering both of those shows? No.
No.
You know, I get the same price. And maybe you should. Maybe that's fair on some of these deals. But with Mania Weekend, I think it's almost inexcusable that a package deal wasn't offered. And I also think, on top of it being inexcusable, I also think it was really dumb and stupid business. You know, I just think it all around was dumb. But anyway, we've hammered that point home. Is there anything else you want to mention on the WWE Online front before we move on?
Well, yes. Briefly, before we move on to the next topic, I do want to ask you, are you familiar with the official WWN Live refund and make good policy?
No, let's hear it.
Okay, I don't know if I should read through all of it, but I'll start at least. Let's see, malfunction? Oh yeah, we have two sections to it. Malfunction on WWN Live side, malfunction on viewer side. So if the malfunction is on their side, as a quote, in the event of a significant technical issue, a refund will be given under these conditions. It has to last longer than 15 minutes. The viewer must request a refund at the time of the malfunction by emailing help at wwnlive.com and using the live help button found on the left-hand side of the screen. So you have to do both. So the problem has to last longer than 15 minutes. You have to contact two different things. You must immediately terminate watching the stream. So you can't sit there waiting for it to come back. If you're getting a refund, too bad, you're out. The viewer must have logged in less than 60 minutes total for the pay-per-view event. This includes time before the malfunction. So if basically at the 60-minute mark the show stops working, you're screwed. If the viewer does not qualify for a refund to the above stipulations, WWN Live will still offer an automatic make-good in the event of a significant technical issue for longer than 15 minutes on their side. If they purchase the live showing, a viewer will be upgraded to the VOD. If they purchase the live and VOD, the viewer will be awarded a free VOD of a past show. The IPV must precede the date of the malfunctioning pay-per-view. Well, you already said a past show. I guess they're talking about WrestleMania weekend type stuff because it could still be passed if you asked later. I don't know. The free VOD make good cannot be redeemed by emailing help, blah, 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 blah. The viewer will be activated to watch this free pay-per-view within 72 hours. Yeah. And then if the malfunction is on the viewer's side, including internet outages and other connection issues, use the live help button on the left side of the screen for media sense. Okay, so if your internet goes out to the point where you're not going to be able to watch the show, they'll help you if you contact them immediately on the internet.
You better hope you have a 3G plan.
You better have a smartphone. They will help you self-connect. Yeah, I don't know if you'd be able to do the live help on the phone, though.
That's a good question.
Wouldn't it make more sense to just have the email for that? Refunds can only be given if the viewer has logged in less than 15 minutes of the iPay-per-view in question. This allows you to test your connection and seek live help. There are no make-good options. So pretty much they're saying that, it has to be less than 15 minutes. So pretty much they're saying it's only in the event of if your connection is not actually good enough. Because if your connection happens to magically go out within the first 15 minutes, go ahead.
Keep in mind, this is a company that charges $5 more for VOD. And so the point is, if you're trying to save some money, you're assuming a huge risk.
Mm.
Because if it doesn't work, you might be screwed. But
and the save some money price. Well, and the save some money price point is the magic $10, which I think we talked about last time.
You
that.
Know.
I'm more inclined to order an iPay-per-view from WWN Live than most because if you do remember to order it before the day of, it is $10.
Yeah. And the shows they put on are easily worth $10.
Yeah.
But enough about that.
So one more follow-up before we move on. WWE did file its usual initially sealed John Doe lawsuit in San Jose. And this is, again, for those who didn't listen to the first show, and you really should if you didn't, so go do that after you listen to this. Every year, WWE will file a suit against a number of John Doe defendants, and if you don't know what John Doe means, I'm not explaining it to you. And they file it's initially filed under seal, which means that it's basically a secret between them and the judge, a very, very special, special secret, but that only you and I know. And if you tell anyone, I'll kill you and your parents, that type of secret.
I don't think that's how it works, but we'll run with that.
Are you sure?
I don't think they actually murder your family.
I'm just saying they threaten to. I'm kidding.
No, you're right.
I'm kidding. In case anyone from WWE happens to be listening to, which is, I'm sure they're not. Although actually, with what we're talking about later, they may pursue all related internet things. So who knows? So yes, WWE's, they file a sealed lawsuit, which means it's secret until it's not. When was it? It was about a week and a half ago that I think Chris Harrington beat me to searching to see if it had gone public yet, and it had. Not too much of interest on the actual lawsuit side this time. It was mostly that the filing included as an exhibit in showing WWE's interstate commerce, showed their schedule that they have set up for the next year, which also included building capacity, sellouts the last time, etc. So that was all interesting to read, and Chris has that all up on his blog, which is indeed wrestling.blogspot.com. And in terms of the other filings and stuff, really the main things that I saw of interest were they included, I think this was, so this was after I think they started doing stuff, or I forget if it, right, because they weren't able to do anything last year. Instagram posts from people who had things seized by WWE. And I couldn't quite figure out what WWE was trying to say, but you had people who were either surprised and sort of understanding that people that thought they had bought legitimate WWE fat heads, which are those giant cartoon head things, or were selling bootlegs and being weirdly fake about and sort of bragging about WWE seizing them. I couldn't really figure it out, but it looked like, you know, t-shirts and fat heads were what they were seizing. And for at least the second year in a row, they were trying to get across the importance of what they're doing by talking about the children. Now, most of the people that would be buying these shirts, or that the shirts would be bought for, that it would be like parents who don't know any better because they're not fans buying for their children. Because, of course, the WWE universe, I guess, would know if it's a legitimate t-shirt or not. And one of their points was that, well, there were a few. A, the bootleggers, when hiding these shirts, hide them in their pants. So you are giving you are buying bootleg t-shirts that were stuffed down a questionable man's pants, and you're buying these for your children. So WWE saying, hey, that's a bad idea. They also added that these shirts may have an unusual odor. Now.
Well, yeah, of course, if they're stuffed down somebody's pants.
I'm not sure if they were implying that or if they were talking about some chemicals, but chemical fumes.
That sort of follows.
Or maybe both. If you don't want your children to be, you know, harmed by the fumes caused by a wrestling fan's balls, then you don't buy those bootleg shirts. And then finally, and this is something of a legitimate point, the bootleg shirts may have inferior quality ink that could be highly flammable. Something like that. Now, the implication was that WWE official t-shirts are not flammable. Or, at the very least, that the bootleg t-shirts are more flammable. But they're t-shirts. They're not pajamas. They are not flame-retardant pajamas.
I can't. It's unbelievable. As we record this show, I didn't know if I was going to share this on the air, but I figure why not.
Okay.
As we record the show, I just wanted to know that my brother's house actually burned down yesterday. the oldest of four boys, and my younger brother that's closest to me in age, who also lives in the Charleston area, His home actually burned down yesterday, and I think I'm going to have to ask him if he had any bootleg WWE shirts in the house, which may have contributed to the loss of everything he owned. Because I would really, I might need to get in on this thing with the WWE. Maybe I can work together with Jerry McDivitt, and we can go after these criminal bootleggers who may be responsible for raising my brother's home. So. A little early to be making light of this, I suppose.
Yes, and yes. By the way, I did ask Dylan if he was okay with talking about the flammability before the show.
Yes, he did. Yes, Vix was very sensitive about that issue. But it's such an absurd, unbelievable, ridiculous. I mean, what do you even say to that? Like, that just reeks of like we want to find a way to make these guys look like bad people, not like just like. Thieves or bootleggers or whatever, which I think there's a lot of gray area, which we've talked about in the past on this show and elsewhere, mm-hmm. Where some people sort of, there's a varying degree among most people of how they view the morality of something like that, you know, and we're really going to get into that with the next discussion, I think, but,
yes.
I feel like here, it's like you bring up the issue of you might catch a blaze while wearing this shirt. As sort of a way of making these people look like scumbags, not just like, maybe guys making profit off things that aren't entirely theirs or maybe aren't theirs at all, but legitimately dirty, rotten scoundrels.
All right.
It's so silly. It's just,
Now I did. Okay. I pulled it up
of reaching.
Just for the record. So we have this all verbatim and actually said the points are a little more clear. And so we don't miss anything. Counterfeit products sold at WWE live events, traditionally sized for children to wear. Okay. That was the issue. It was that, they were saying that most of these have been children's size shirts. Okay, so that's whatever. If you want to say that it's kind of crappy to get a child the fake shirt, whatever. Okay, I can sort of get that. So then we get it wasn't just inferior ink quality that could be flammable. It was inferior shirt quality. Inferior shirt quality could be flammable. Let's think about this for a second. It's a T-shirt. T-shirts are flammable.
Hold on, Vix. I like the idea of like your 9-year-old kid that you bought a knockoff Roman Reigns T-shirt for smoking a cigarette and accidentally ashing on it and catching it on fire. Like I don't. I really don't. Look, this is. But you know why this is? You know, yes, it's funny to include on the show or whatever. But you know why also this is, I think, relevant is. This shows you the absurdity of the arguments that'll get thrown into some of these cases.
Yes.
I mean, they will pull the most ridiculous shit imaginable out of their ass in order to make people look bad or sort of hype kids. Like on episode one, we talked about the absurd amount of valuation they put on the DVDs that were seized.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What was it? WrestleCon, I guess.
It was WrestleCon. The first WrestleCon. Yeah.
The first WrestleCon. So like, This is what these attorneys do, and I'm not knocking all attorneys, far from it, but this is kind of the name of the game with a lot of this IP-related stuff, is, you sort of throw in and tag on this extra crap because this is an issue where the American public as a whole sort of doesn't, I don't know that we have a fixed moral position on the issue of intellectual property and things like licensing and trademark and whatnot. And so, it's harder to make an appeal to the public based solely around that. So you go for the jugular by saying your children will be set on fire.
Right. And then they also had inferior ink quality could be flammable, cause allergic reactions. So wait, does that mean only inferior ink can cause allergic reactions? I didn't quite get that. Counterfeiters keep them stored, with stored in quotes, scare quotes, in their pants until sale is made.
Maybe that has something to do with the inferior ink quality.
I'm not even sure what that joke was supposed to mean. often have strong adverse odors, not noticed until indoors, and then in all caps, pose a significant public safety risk! By the way, this was not a legal argument. This was, it was like, just, I think this was an exhibit, and it was signed off by someone that works for WWE. Maybe that might be a lawyer, but I mean, this was not an official argument of any kind. To give them a slight, I don't even know. Just to be a little bit fair to them. Now, by the way, did you see? Was it last week that shirt that I tweeted a link to on Amazon?
No.
Okay. What's the best way for me to send this to you right now? Which chat?
You can text it. Fire it to me.
Or on Skype. Are you still logged into Skype?
Yeah.
I'll send it in Skype chat.
Okay, that'll work.
Okay. Because well, yes, as I'm sure some people have noticed that yes, Dylan is on his cell phone for technical reasons. So I just sent it to you on Skype. Now this is
okay. Here's the big reveal. It is labeled. Live reveal, folks.
It's a Z Yuan men's WWE Finn Balor Devil T-shirt. So what we've got. Do you want to describe this, or should I?
Okay. Here's how I would describe this, and I'll let you. You can follow if you like.
And it's available in all sorts of different colors, by the way.
You got okay. The color of this picture, like the background of the shirt, the picture that Vix is forwarding me here, is like a semen colored shirt,
clearly stored in someone's pants.
And in the upper, on the upper breast, I guess it's the left hand side if you're wearing it, right hand side if you're looking at it, is the Finn Balor logo, which I assume is the official Finn Balor. I'm not even sure if this is actually his official logo.
I think it is.
But it may be the official Finn Balor logo. It's sort of this red and white, almost like it's a combination of his name and the Balor sort of droops down, has sort of a fang look to it. And then on the left side of the shirt, running pretty much the full length of the shirt, is a picture of Roman Reigns holding both of the heavyweight titles, just casually over his shoulder.
Which is, and giving the thumbs up in a possibly photoshopped thumbs up. And then, I didn't even notice this till now. Especially if you have to be zoomed in to really notice this. The letters SB and maybe a crappy spray painting font right under Reigns' left wrist, which makes it pretty clear that this was some Roman Reigns fan fantasy art project that they just took off the internet.
But you can get it for $23.99.
Yes, and by the way, yeah, actually, wait—is this fulfilled by Amazon? I guess it would say no. It would say Prime if it did. So, that, not fulfilled by Amazon, I guess. So they are not actually shipping any of these things. There are 23 customer reviews, which I'm guessing are mostly parodies. I would hope.
I don't know. I mean, but here's the problem. You know what? This kind of shoots a hole in the WWE's argument, though, because I don't think there's no evidence, at least, from this visual depiction that this was ever in a man's pants.
Well, I don't think they seized any of these. I don't think they seized any of these fine Chinese-made Roman Balor shirts.
Well...
So speaking of made-to-order wrestling T-shirts and internet and intellectual property, Pro Wrestling Tees has been in the news a bunch lately. Some of this goes back a little bit further. We're really more just going to bring that up because there are a bunch of things to talk about with them. The latest came out last week. So it was Mike Johnson that reported to PW Insider that it's part of all the weird WWE and Steve Austin stuff going on. That they had sent a cease and desist letter to have a few of his shirts removed from ProWrestlingTees.com. Pro Wrestling Tees, for those who don't know, and guessing most of the people that listen to this would know, but just in case you don't, a few years ago, you may remember on Cole Cabana's podcast, one of his advertisers, his sponsors, was 1 Hour Tees, a t-shirt shop in Chicago that he used to print his various t-shirts. I don't know exactly how it came about. But he was one of the first people on board when they created ProWrestlingTees.com, a direct marketplace where a wrestler could get artwork made up And then Pro Wrestling Tees prints the shirts for them, does fulfillment, etc. The wrestlers make money. They sell directly to fans. It's a tremendous idea. I mean, I would think you would agree.
In theory, yes.
So they've had some issues, but they've only been around what, year and a half in this guise
not
with
long
the pro
at
wrestling
all. Yeah.
With the Pro Wrestling Tees gimmick. They have signed up basically everyone that's not in WWE. They have a deal with New Japan. They have a deal with Randy Savage's family. They have a deal with Andre the Giant's estate. Everything that they could cover, pretty much, they have in terms of that. Also,
and they signed people up quickly. Like, yeah. I think when CJ Parker left NXT, he was signed up like a day later. Right. So, I mean, this is like an immediate type deal.
Right. This is also the main place to get, for example, the Young Buck shirts and all that stuff. And also, they also, not long after starting Pro Wrestling Tees, bought up BarbershopWindow.com. And I don't know exactly what led to that, if the original Barbershop guys were just getting out. But, yeah. So they also own Barbershop Window, which made the various parody shirts and stuff like that. So WWE sent them a cease and desist over some Austin shirts, and that was really all Mike Johnson left it at. So I decided to do some detective work. So the first thing I do is I see they said it was WrestleMania week. So I open up the Austin store on Pro Wrestling Tees, see what it looks like now. Next to it, next tab, I put it into Wayback Machine. I look up what it looked like before the week of WrestleMania. There were two shirts that are no longer there. Although there was another one that had disappeared that came back that doesn't look like it had anything to do with WWE. That Austin said it would be back, and it was within a couple days. So the two that were gone were a NWO-style shirt with BSR, Broken Skull Ranch, and it was called, in the description, New World BSR. And then the other one was a photo of Austin doing his hands up posed on the second turnbuckle that was called Austin Era. And I think it said that in the logo on the shirt. So, obviously the NWO thing, that's a trademark of WWE's. They own it, obviously, buying WCW, etc. I'm sure people are going to wonder about the BWO. I am not a lawyer, but the BWO was a clear parody. It was the logo and shirt of something that was a legitimate parody. This is not really a parody. I mean, right? I mean, both of us being laymen, I think we can agree that it's not actually a parody or any kind of criticism.
The theory is it's not a parody. It is utilizing an image that is associated with a trademark brand of another company for material gain. I mean, that's what the theory is. I would argue that the definition of parody is very much debatable in a context like this, but
in the legal context, as far as we know, as laymen, yeah.
I'm sure the argument. The argument is certainly that this is not a parody. Yes,
right. I'm sure that's I would be sure that's WWE's argument. I'd be shocked if it wasn't. So then the Austin Era shirt. So now, Pro Wrestling Tees is at least the way it's set up. You can't right click and get the image. So I did. I googled for the shirt, and Google Image Search pulled it up in high resolution. So it's whatever. So I reverse Google Image Search, and I actually got no results. So next, I used an older reverse image search tool called TinEye, which existed before Google had reverse image search, but sometimes gets different results, and it did. So I see that the image is on Getty Images. So I have no idea. If I had to guess, I'm guessing that Pro Wrestling Tees at least tried to license it from Getty Images. Because they don't seem to be quite as diligent enough as they should be, but I wouldn't expect them to be that stupid. The problem is, so then I'm looking through it, and I'm saying, okay, how much does this cost? Is this amount that they might have paid? And it was like, it looked like it actually seemed reasonable enough. And then I'm going through the steps, I'm doing a mock checkout, and I see something like, notice, this shirt also requires third-party permission, and it may have even been specifically because I chose T-shirt. Please get more information, blah, 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 blah. So I fire up the support chat. I said, okay, but this one, it said I requires third-party permission. And they said, and what did you want to use it for? I said, T-shirts. And they said, you would need permission from the person in the photo, which is Austin, which obviously they do have, and WWE. So obviously, if WWE sent them a cease and desist, they probably did not get permission from WWE. And So I put this up on Wrestling Inc., where I'm now contributing some stuff during the week. And I was... I try not to be surprised by comment sections, especially on bigger sites. But I was surprised that the majority of the reaction was, how dare WWE go after this person who kept their company from going out of business? So, what are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, first of all, as my dogs go crazy in the background, but as a practical matter, I don't think it really matters because Steve Austin doesn't need the money. I hate that argument, generally speaking, but I would just, this isn't going to be going after Young Bucks or somebody like CJ Parker, for example, who just decided to leave and go out on his own. This is the WWE. Now, the theory, of course, or the question mark, I guess, is does this have something to do with retribution, the involving Austin because of potential issues that may involve things he said that pissed off Vince McMahon when they did the live podcast? I don't know. That's very, very hard to say. It could be that somebody in WWE legal decided that they got to get a bug up their ass and go after Pro Wrestling Tees because Pro Wrestling Tees threatens their online sales. You know, they threaten WWE merchandise. You know, I because they are big, like you outlined at the beginning of this discussion. I mean, they all are behemoths within that particular field of pro wrestling merchandise. I mean, they're not WWE shop, but you know, there's nobody. I mean, I would, without thinking too much about it, with the possible exception of High Spots, I can't think of anybody else who has a comparably, large sort of platform, a successful platform that they do. So it's certainly not one that caters to such a specific niche within the pro wrestling merchandising universe.
Right.
So it very well could be that they were just going after somebody who they see as a potential competitor, which is what you often see in these cases. And by the way, I'm going to go ahead and integrate this in here. That is precisely what you saw Pro Wrestling Tees do to certain fans who had made, handmade items of various sorts using New Japan Pro Wrestling, likenesses.
Now, what was the site?
Theoretical
likenesses, yes.
Theoretical likenesses. Like, I believe, and I wish I could remember all the exact details of this, but a few months back, case I remember,
I'm trying to remember what website this was on. It was a site where you can sell stuff that has your art. And I think most of these people are not selling T-shirts, by the way.
No. I don't remember if this was Etsy or...
Etsy-type thing. It was something... Did it have red in the name?
It could have. All I remember... But there was a couple of them, I think, that happened on the same day. But the one that I think got the most play around the Twitter sphere was the pro wrestling blogger, Daniel Matheson, who I believe was in the Toronto area and is sort of a big super wrestling fan who goes to a lot of independent, really big supporter of independent wrestling and things of that nature. She also makes her own handcrafted, for lack of a better term, sort of artisan style, pro wrestling items that she sells in one of these Etsy-like shops. And I believe one of the items was like a Jushin Liger, theoretically, the likeness of Jushin Liger, I think maybe a pillow or something of that nature.
It was a pillow or an oven mitt or something.
Yeah, and Pro Wrestling Tees, basically went after and had it taken down. And, to me, I find that to be completely ridiculous. Now, to be fair, I don't know if Pro Wrestling Tees went after her at the behest of New Japan,
which is what they said.
No, I don't know that.
Or they either said or implied.
That is theoretically possible. We can't rule that out as something that's impossible. I also don't know if this was a case of them going after somebody who, because it's not as if Daniel Matheson is super well known, but she's fairly well known within certain circles.
And she writes for Uproxx.
She writes for Uproxx. Maybe it's just that her profile was big enough. I mean, there's a lot of things that you can guess. And I don't believe she was the only person that got hit. I just think she was the person of the most note that got hit during this. But if you look at the item itself, which I looked at the time, I mean, to me, this is one of those things where, I've already let my biases be known on episode one. I don't really believe in intellectual property, but I'm not going to get into that right now. The point to me is, even if you're a really ardent supporter of intellectual property rights, if somebody makes an item like this particular item, I find it really hard to argue that this person should not be able to sell this good without the express permission of New Japan Pro Wrestling or Jushin Liger. This is not an exact replica. This is not somebody selling a mask of someone.
It wasn't even a shirt.
It's not even a shirt, of course.
It was
not
a print. I think it was just a print. She said
it might have been
looking
a print.
At her tweet.
The point is, it's certainly not is a bootleg. You know, I don't think you can call this a bootleg. You can call this, if you want to argue that this is unlawful use of a likeness, I suppose that's debatable. I think it's kind of absurd, but I guess it's within the realm of debate. But what you cannot do is call this a bootleg. It is not a bootleg anything. There's no, to me, this would be, going after somebody in a Day of the Dead parade because they had a getup that looked like the Guatemalan luchador Madame Xanadu. yes, I realize there's sales issues involved. I just think it's completely ridiculous. My point in sort of drawing this connection and mentioning it is in the context of the Steve Austin stuff is that I think you have to look at this as being an issue where Pro Wrestling Tees is guilty of something that they are also a victim of, which is a trademark claim or a likeness issue or licensing issue related claim that is, I would argue, fairly petty in the grand scheme of things.
I would argue, with the Austin one, though, I would argue the photo is not. I would argue that one's not.
I think it is. But, I think that one is...
I feel like it's
petty.
Just so blatant. That one, it's certainly the least petty of any of these.
Yeah, yes. I agree with that. I think this whole case, if you take it as a whole, sort of illustrates the weirdness of the IP issue, because the point here is, regardless of your position on IP, whether you're heavily supporting, ardently in favor of, or militantly opposed to, or somewhere in the middle, the point is that in practice, almost anybody who's involved in the business of distributing content involving people other than themselves in any way, shape, or form is walking a tightrope when it comes to IP. And on certain cases, you're going to, unless you're really good about covering your bases, which I think is actually very, very hard and very difficult in the world as it is right now, mm-hmm. You're potentially brushing up against some sort of thing that might be vaguely illegal a lot of the time, and this is just, it's an interesting development, I think. And Pro Wrestling Tees, I think in general, is going to be interesting to follow going forward to see how they follow up, with the Austin issue. Like, I mean, how careful are they going to be going forward? How aggressive are they going to be, in sort of protecting the things that they have licensing rights or trademark rights to? I don't know. I think this is going to be an interesting thing to follow because they're such a unique company relative to a lot of the other vendors that are out there.
Yes. And what was it? One thing I wanted to add, though, is that they did not pull every single or WWE, as far as I can tell. If it's assuming they pulled everything WWE asked them to pull, they haven't pulled every NWO knockoff type shirt. I mean, there's even one on the Young Bucks store still. So,
which maybe the argument there is that somehow qualifies as parody and yet it does.
That you could argue I guess I can sort of see what you're saying, that you could argue that the Young Bucks whole thing is parodying of the NWO.
Yeah, I mean, their gimmick is basically, millennial trolls. I mean, that's basically what their gimmick is. So, to me, that's getting really into meta territory, though.
Yes.
I mean, if you're arguing that that's protected as parody, but something else isn't because of their in-ring wrestling character, I mean, that is kind of bizarre.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
The reason I was surprised was that, and I bring them up, is because that is someone that it seemed like WWE was at least prepping to go after.
We
didn't discuss this the first time, actually. I think it was before we did the first show, that for those who aren't aware, that you probably would have read it somewhere, but that WWE kind of out of nowhere trademarked the click hand sign, or the wolf hand sign, or whatever you want to call it, because it has a bunch of different uses both in and out of wrestling. And it was like the same week that it came out, I don't know if that was when the trademark went through or whatever, that they had the at least one or two different promos that were seemingly worded specifically to call them out on TV.
In theory, the Mark Henry Young Bucks promo.
I mean, they are.
I forget what the other one was.
Now that they are doing the new Click DVD and stuff, maybe it makes a little more sense in an innocuous context. But I was surprised though that they didn't at least try to pull the Young Bucks one. If they did that. Pro Wrestling Tees didn't comply. But, oh yeah, and by the way, I did find the Danielle Matheson tweet. It was Redbubble was the site that she had her stuff on, and her tweet at the time was, "Pro Wrestling Tweets, a site 98% comprised of ripoff designs and traced images, just had my Liger prints pulled from Redbubble." Yeah.
Yes.
So.
And I think that raises, if you do a print of Jushin Liger, which is not even an exact... I mean, like, there's a lot of artistic license that she applies to. Actually, it looks really good.
All right, I think I know where you're going with this. How is this different from a photo that she would own if she took a photo
of
him?
How is that any different than a photo? I mean, it's completely... It's just really dumb. Pro Wrestling Tees may have, like I said, they may have been doing the bidding in New Japan. They seem to have implied they were doing the bidding in New Japan. But again, this is a case of some, and keep in mind that Barbershop Window, which they acquired, at times seemed to be flagrantly violating trademark stuff. So
yeah.
I this may be another case, like some other famous cases that we discussed or referred to sort of cryptically in episode one, Rob Feinstein, of people who make their money, or a lot of their original startup capital is directly wedded to things that are absolutely violations of IP to one degree or another, somebody else's intellectual property. And then once they are in a position where they have sort of a large foothold in the market, suddenly they are the enforcer, which I think says a lot about how much people actually care about intellectual property and how much of it is just, trying to secure your piece of the pie. But, hey, that's business. That's how it works, I suppose.
Yeah, and now we have one last thing. We don't want to go into this too deep because it's not exactly a wrestling thing before we go to our last and, I guess, main event topic of the show. But it's another Pro Wrestling Tees thing. So this was, what, a week and a half ago? That they announced that they're now starting an MMA site soon?
Yes. I think about 10 days ago or something.
Yeah, so armbarnation.com, and I think the first shirt is already available, even if the site isn't actually up yet. They said, starting this summer, and the first shirt is a Four Horse Women shirt with Ronda Rousey, Marina Shafir, Shayna Baszler, and Jessamine Duke all on it, done in the style of... was it a Crockett era Four Horsemen shirt or done sort of, it's done in the style of one of the older Four Horsemen shirts. And,
yeah.
Or maybe if it wasn't a shirt, it's in the style of one of the photos with one of the logos. Anyway, that is the first shirt. And I can't remember if the shirt is available yet, but they already have, they've already announced it. So a few very interesting things about this. First of all, that Ronda Rousey is involved with the first shirt. And that it seems to be done primarily as a way of having something marketable that her friends and roommates will make money off of. So good for her for doing that. The other thing is that it's launching this summer. And what else is happening this summer is starting in, I believe, the first or second week of July, UFC's new deal with Reebok goes into effect. So what is the most succinct way we can explain this for people who are not MMA fans? UFC fighters...
Sponsorship has gone away because Reebok has taken over. I mean, I don't even know how...
Well, there are a few things. Well, you know, boxers, race car drivers, in athletes in those kind of individual sports have sponsors on their gear and stuff like that. Several years ago, UFC added a sponsor tax where they would charge $100,000 for the right to advertise on a fighter in the UFC, with the logic being, hey, we have TV deals, you're advertising on our show. And to be fair, they are, even though it became a barrier for the fighters. The argument is one that has merit. Whether or not they should have done it is a whole different issue. But that became an issue for the fighters, although they don't always charge the sponsor tax. They seem to only charge the sponsor tax in, like, MMA clothing fields and supplements and stuff like that. Like, Dynamic Fastener, which is a company that makes, like, industrial strength fasteners for clothing, or not clothing, for construction, is now all over MMA fighters' gear, in part because UFC is not charging them the sponsor tax because their brand has nothing to do with MMA. So, there's all that, and also UFC didn't want Condom Depot on fighter shorts anymore and stuff like that. So then they signed this uniform deal with Reebok. Starting in July, every fighter is going to be wearing a Reebok uniform, and that's that. And if they have sponsors, the sponsors can still use them for outside stuff. Only one or two sponsors have actually committed to sticking with their fighters. And also, if it's during fight week, or you're even training at the gym, but UFC is shooting footage of you, you have to wear the Reebok stuff. You can't wear anything else. So this is changing. As the change is going on, Armbar Nation will be opening up, and you will have a central place, theoretically, if Rousey's there, I'm guessing other fighters will flock there, to buy your MMA shirts to support your favorite fighters. So even though they won't be able to promote it on TV, I would think, unless maybe they end up giving ArmbarNation.com shoutouts or whatever, it looks like this could be an interesting and maybe good way for the fighters to make some of the lost money. Although it should be noted that Reebok will be paying the fighters certain amounts of money, but the way it's going to work, no one really has any clue yet. So, Dylan, go ahead. I hope I didn't.
Well, first of all,
as succinct I could have been, by the way? I couldn't think of any of.
Probably so, yes. I think it's really, really funny that the first shirt is potentially a trademark violation of a WWE-owned trademark. So that in and of itself, I think it's hilarious. I mean, I'd be shocked if they went after them for that, especially because there's some sort of relationship between WWE and Rousey, but it's pretty funny, to be honest. The only other thing I really want to comment on this is that I think the issue, like, it's going to be interesting to see if MMA fighters can monetize the pro wrestling tees offshoot and make a substantial sum of money there that they may or may not be losing through sponsorship. I don't know that that's going to work, to be honest. But I don't. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
It's Armbar Apparel, not Armbar Nation. Armbar Nation, I think, is the official Rousey regular website. So it's Armbar Apparel.
Okay. But I don't know. Well, I think this is. It's too early to see what this is. Or to know for sure what sort of effect this is going to have. But it could have a. It could be a way for some of these fighters to make some money, which, you know, is a good thing. I don't know how happy UFC is going to be about this, because I think they're a pretty, what's the word I'm looking for? Totalitarian brand. But I also don't know that there's a whole lot they can do about it. So I don't know. I think it's, we'll see where this goes. This could turn out to be a huge boon, especially for fighters that are potentially really marketable. I also think the question is going to be, like, one interesting thing that will be worth following going forward is for fighters like Anderson Silva or Nick Diaz or other people who are suspended or will be suspended and potentially out of the game, is this going to be a way for them to monetize their, really, in some cases, incredible popularity without actually fighting.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, obviously it's not going to pay well to fight. Well, I don't know. It depends on how well it's marketed. But that's kind of an interesting side story to, I think about and look at.
And it is a great idea. I mean, even if you didn't have the whole sponsor change thing going on, it is a good idea. I mean, the idea is, okay, now you can support your fighter, favorite fighter directly. The same idea as pro wrestling tees. I mean, that's what it is. The timing is just what makes it especially interesting.
Yes. Yes. And I got to tell you, there are some potential design ideas that would be really, really great. Like a Diaz Brothers shirt with like a Cypress Hill spook background, maybe. Or something of that ilk. There's a lot of stuff that I would potentially, I don't know if I'd buy it, but I would at least find it amusing and hilarious.
Right.
And it's also worth noting that WWE signed a deal with Tap Out recently.
Well, the Tap Out deal is not to make WWE merchandise. The Tap Out deal is just for Tap Out to be the official athletic lifestyle clothing brand of WWE. The other deal they signed was, now I'm forgetting their name all of a sudden, the company that makes, junk food.
Oh, God.
Junk food is the one that makes, they make the various like cartoon nostalgia t-shirts and stuff like that.
But my point there wasn't necessarily – my point was that there's like some cross-pollination going around with the pro wrestling sort of identified
yes.
T-shirt gigs and the MMA identified T-shirt thingies. Like there's it's kind of an interesting story. I don't know. I think it's too soon to say what it's going to mean. But I do think it's worth – for me, the most interesting aspect really is going to see like – if some of these guys who are suspended fighters are fighters who are maybe nearing retirement age and perhaps should retire because they don't have the tools they used to have, like somebody like, say, a Josh Koscheck, for example, who has name value to at least one degree or another and is a recognizable face to probably a lot of MMA fans, including a lot of people who aren't even super hardcore MMA fans because of his time on The Ultimate Fighter, if guys like this are going to be able to monetize it. Because you would expect that the top stars and even maybe some of the more charismatic secondary stars that are, you know, active performers are going to monetize it. But what about these guys who are out on drug suspensions or who are sort of in their waning days of their career? Or, you know, to me, that is kind of an interesting aspect when it comes to that.
Right. And also kind of going along with one of the other reasons why pro wrestling tees has been popular in the first place, like, even though they're bad for different reasons, like how you want wrestling shirts that don't look like wrestling shirts, you also want MMA shirts that don't look like MMA shirts.
Yes, that is very true.
If you look at the MMA shirts that have been the most popular, you know, the big one that I think of is the Korean Zombie shirt, which everyone loved because it looked nothing like an MMA shirt.
Yeah, you don't want to be... You don't want to be caught wearing certain shirts that aren't hip. You know, I don't even know how it's written. You don't want to be caught in public wearing a Roman Reigns WWE produced shirt.
Right.
Especially one made or one made by a bootlegger that may or may not have caught my brother's house.
Or was down anyone's pants, or
or all of the above, but okay.
So the big story.
Yeah, we got to segue to it. So I'll let you get the ball rolling.
Okay, you don't want to lead on this one.
Well, I mean, okay, I'll lead it in the form of a plug.
Okay.
The last big show.
Yes.
Which of course. Of course, is hosted by my co-host for this show, David Bixenspan, the guy who pitched to me to make this pitch, was done with Doug Gilbert. For those who don't know who Doug Gilbert is, he's the brother of Eddie Gilbert, son of Tommy Gilbert. He's a sort of a Memphis wrestling stalwart in his own right, and actually a very underrated performer in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that interview is great. It's well worth listening to. Bix did a great job with it, and I would encourage everybody to give it a listen. But we're not going to talk about that interview per se. What we're going to talk about is the fact that the Gilbert family, of which Doug is, of course, a member, is suing the WWE. Why, you say?
Well, not just WWE.
Because, okay, who are all the parties in the website, or in the lawsuit, rather?
Okay, Doug on his own behalf, Tommy as Eddie's estate, are suing both ESPN and WWE.
That's right, okay. They because of the global stuff, they are suing these two major, I'm going to use the term content providers because I think it's obnoxious, but it fits. Two major content providers because of the use of Eddie Gilbert's likeness on various forms of programming that is distributed by each of those two brands. In the case of ESPN, it's the Global Wrestling Federation reruns that ESPN Classics has been running for quite some time now. And in the case of the WWE, it's all sorts of stuff, I guess in theory, that the WWE has put out either in DVD form or more specifically, I think the implication is via the WWE Network, where, you know, Eddie is... a lot of the early ECW TV that's included... would include Eddie,
which also has and Doug on the ECW stuff.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
As Dark Patriot.
As a Dark Patriot. You know, you've got Eddie pops up often on early WCW pay-per-views. So he's going to be in both of those places. He may even show up some other spots on the network. I don't think they've got any Smoky Mountain up that would be germane to this. But they're making the point is there's in theory several places, not an overwhelming amount of Eddie Gilbert content on the network, but certainly several places where you could find Eddie Gilbert on the WWE Network. And the Gilbert family and the Eddie Gilbert estate, I suppose, is the argument is that there's been no compensation for this. And that it is a, for lack of a better term, a moral crime. You know, I assume most of the people who are listening to this are aware of the fact that Eddie Gilbert died. I guess in 1995.
20 years ago, a few months ago, when I wrote my article about him in Fighting Spirit.
Yeah, you know, which, you know, he died in Puerto Rico, and he sort of had a really underrated career in wrestling as both a wrestling mind and a performer and a talker, where I really think he was, you know, that was his biggest strength. But, yeah, so this is I thought a pretty out of the blue lawsuit, to be honest with you.
Yes.
And an interesting one in a lot of ways, but one of the, I think, you know, and I'll let you filibuster on this here in a second, but I think in some ways the most interesting thing about it is the fact that Eddie Gilbert, while I'm certainly a fan, I know you're a fan, it's not, I mean, this is not somebody who is an overwhelming presence on the WWE Network. This is, and I don't mean this to be disrespectful, in many ways, this is a bit player. I mean, this is not somebody who was on tons and tons of pay-per-views, not necessarily presented in a high-profile way, even on the pay-per-views and things that it, and the content that he is on. So this is kind of an interesting case. I mean, I don't want to say it's the equivalent of you know, an undercard jobber guy suing along the same lines, but it's closer to that than it is like somebody like, you know, Steve Austin or The Rock, so, you know, or even somebody like a Bobby Eaton, who's probably on there even more. This is just a really interesting case.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, not the first time this has happened. WWE's also been sued by Doug Summers. They were sued. ESPN was sued by Wild Thing Steve Ray, which I was not aware of until I read one of the filings, and it was a joint motion where ESPN explained they had prevailed in a previous lawsuit of their own, and I am forgetting one. WWE also talked about how they also won a lawsuit over Ricky Steamboat, which was not a well-known one, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But Doug Summers was more recent, talking about how he'd been on the various Shawn Michaels DVDs and all that. And I'm trying to remember, did Doug Summers actually want them to stop selling the DVDs, or did he want royalties? Because this one's just about royalties.
I don't remember, to be honest. It seems odd if he wasn't asking for royalties.
Or, well, because TMZ was pushing it as strange. or that the Gilberts were only asking for royalties and not for them to stop selling it. Which, now, so the first thing I want to ask, you may know this better than me. Doesn't WWE these days have a reputation of if a wrestler that has been on DVDs comes to them and has never gotten royalties, even if they didn't work directly with WWE, WWE will give them money?
Okay. To the best of my knowledge, which mm-hmm. is admittedly not, I don't know everything about this, but to the best of my knowledge, well, let me just put it this way. That has certainly happened before. I can say with pretty much 100% certainty that there have been people who were not receiving any compensation for certain appearances on WWE, produced content, who went to the WWE, raised a fuss, or did whatever, and got at least something out of it. That has certainly happened before. Now, whether or not that is the official policy of the WWE, I think is, or even the unofficial policy, I think is a completely separate question. This could be one of these things, sort of like how Vince McMahon will, it's official policy that they'll pay for anybody's rehab, right? But it's sort of an unofficial policy that Vince McMahon at many, many times has contributed to the funeral expenses of wrestlers who have died young.
Right.
So I don't know where this falls on that spectrum, I guess is how I would put it.
Right. I'm trying to remember where I first heard about it. It was an argument between, who was it, Rob Viper and Bahu? So I remember Hayabusa coming up and whether or not it was, I can't remember if it was, it may not have been with Rob, but I want to say it involved Bahu, who ran it still exists, the website BahuFMW.com, which is a great resource if you're looking for stuff about FMW.
Tremendous site.
I can't remember who was arguing what. There was something about whether or not Hayabusa had gotten royalties for being on one of the ECW DVDs. And I can't remember if it was him saying that WWE had got it. I want to say it was, might have even, not that Rob usually defends WWE, but I'm trying to remember who it was. There was someone that was defending WWE by saying, if someone comes to them, they will pay them. Like, if you point out, hey, I've never gotten royalties, I'm on this DVD, especially if you're in a match and, a featured match on DVD, then they would get paid. I don't know why I think it was Rob, though. But he sounds like, I just feel like, I don't know, just a weird gut thing. I'd have to find it. But it makes me wonder, did the Gilberts go to WWE first? If not, were they aware at all that maybe they could try? Then there's also one of the weird things about this. The lawsuit was filed a little over a month ago. The reason we did not know about it was because it was filed locally, local circuit court in Tennessee. WWE and ESPN had it moved to federal court, and that's when it appeared on Pacer online, and that's when everyone who was doing their routine World Wrestling Entertainment search found it. Well, technically TMZ first, but yeah. So, yeah, so, I mean, should we talk about some of the previous lawsuits first and some of the other stuff that's relevant, like Jesse Ventura? I guess, where do we go with this?
Well, I mean, the first thing I'll note is that I just want to mention that, on your show with Doug,
I think I know where you're going with Doug's this, too.
Well, he sort of brought out how the WWE didn't pay these guys. When he was effectively part of WWE developmental,
right? So when USWA and Power Pro were, yeah.
Which cheap plug? If anybody wants to listen to a broad history of WWE developmental,
yes.
Dave Musgrave and I did a pretty good job covering it on the Wrestling Culture Podcast a few episodes back, which is available at clickbnation.com. But I the point there was Doug was sort of getting at the point that these guys, they were expected to work with these younger guys or talent breaking into the business, some who ended up being pretty big stars and some who never really amounted to much. And they were expected to sort of teach them ropes and do all these things and effectively act as their de facto trainers, but they weren't being paid for it. And, in hindsight, I think his comment there is sort of telling, because I think what this really is all about is the idea that I don't think it's so much about the likeness. I mean, it is, because that's what the official filing is about. But I think what this, to a large degree, is about is the idea that there's a group of veterans in this business, in the wrestling business, and I think Doug Summers fits this to Joshua T., very similar in many ways as a worker and as a performer to Doug Gilbert, I might add. But I think there's a mentality, I think, that certain guys in this business did not get what they put into the business. And a lot of what they put in was helping young guys, was sort of cultivating and laying the groundwork for what now is a huge multinational, multimedia empire. And I think a lot of what a suit like this has to do with is not so much the likeness itself as it is trying to use WWN live speak, make good on previous wrongs. And I'm not even saying that that's entirely conscious, but I think that that's what a lot of this has to do with. I don't even know, like, when I hear these old guys talk about, I shouldn't say old guys because it sounds dismissive, when I hear these older stars talk about, the history of the business and their role in it and where things have gone today, a consistent theme is, you know, that they feel like maybe they were undercompensated in some way or another for the contributions that they made. At least relative to today's stars. And I think that a lot of these suits, that's sort of what lays at the heart of them. That goes a little bit beyond the sort of IT-related theme of the show, but I think ultimately it's wedded to it because I think that is at least partially the motivator for this. But I'll let you get into some of the more particulars on some of these other suits. We could talk about that. I just wanted to mention that because I think that's relevant.
Yeah, I mean, he was talking about how, who was it, Bruce Pritchard? Was it Bruce Pritchard or someone else that he said he had talked to that someone was like, I mean, no, maybe not Bruce Pritchard, because, I mean, he was friends with Bruce Pritchard. I mean, they worked together on Long Global. It might not have been Bruce. I'd have to listen to it again to remember who he said. It was someone from WWE that worked with the talent relations and stuff that asked him how things were going, and he said something about not being paid, and he was like, wait, Jr. pays you, right? And he says, well, not much. And I think maybe he made a comment about how even the developmental guys were getting more from WWE than he was getting from, I guess it technically wasn't Jared at that point anymore, but from the USWA or Power Pro. And that was like, you should be paying us. On top of the developmental guys, because we're the ones that are actually developing them as wrestlers, which is a very fair point. And it definitely stuck out in my head once I saw about the lawsuit. I could see, I don't know if it's entirely the motive, but I get what you're saying, that either way it's sort of to try to get a make good overall. But I do think, yeah. I do think this probably bothers a lot of wrestlers, especially guys who, if it was this is one of those things that I bet will, if once it gets kind of dissected in court, may not look good for them. I think they said they never agreed to appear. They never agreed to even have their matches recorded. Did you look at the filing after it got posted? I can't remember.
Yeah, I mean, that's hard to believe when the shows, when most of the events we're talking about, in fact, all of the events that we're talking about are shows that were explicitly recorded.
Right. That was strange.
They were recorded for the sole purpose of dissemination. It's not like they were recorded so, you know, somebody could go, some archivist could look at them for historical research purposes 100 years later. I mean, they were recorded for the purpose of broadcast on television or on pay-per-view. So, yeah.
I don't know if that's just a matter of it. That could just be a matter of the lawyer maybe writing it weird. I would have to think so.
I would hope so.
Yeah, I would hope so. Now, and then also I would think, you know, look, but in a lot of these cases, we're talking about pay-per-views where they probably had to know very well, unless you were really just kind of staying within the wrestler lifestyle, that this stuff was going to be on, also released on videotape. You know, whether it's Eddie's appearances, which were in, you know, relatively featured matches at various pay-per-views, and on some of those Clash of the Champions specials, or Doug's appearance at WrestleWar 89 or in the Royal Rumble 96, that you had to have an idea that these were at least going to come out on home video at the time. Now,
By 86, By the end of 86, there shouldn't have been any doubt to anybody that they were going to be on home video.
Now, as far as TV matches and in certain promotions, I can see why a wrestler would be really pissed off that someone's making money off that now. Because if you're an old school wrestler, the TV was not the product. The TV was something that you were either paid little to nothing for to promote the actual product, which was the house show. And I've seen, you know, someone who I don't always agree with, but I sort of get his point here. Crimson Mask on Wrestling Classics has argued that this, I mean, I think he's talked about that a lot. I talked about it a lot that maybe, I think also Richard Sullivan too, again, someone I don't always agree with, but these shows were, I mean, just things, a lot of these shows, wrestlers could have never had any idea they would be sold for money to the fans. And I could see why, at the very least, even if they might not have a legal claim to it, that would really piss off a wrestler.
It kind of is the same thing as sort of the old school mentality that we talked about earlier. You know, that sort of spits in the face of the old school mentality. Because like you said, a lot of these guys weren't paid much, if at all, for TV, because TV was basically a way to advertise yourself. You know, the house shows is where you made your money. Or later, maybe your pay-per-view payoffs, depending on how far forward you're going. But, yeah, I mean, I get the mentality of the wrestlers on that. Having said that, I don't think that there's a particularly strong case for compensation. I mean, if somebody wanted to sort of make some sort of moral argument, that's, I think, a separate matter. But I don't think there's a particularly good case for comp. I mean, if I buy a record, you know, from a band, when they're not a big deal or whatever, and I play it and I enjoy it or whatever, and then in 25 years, subsequently the band has become a huge, huge deal, and this is limited and hand numbered LP or whatever, and I turn around and sell it for a $5,000 profit, I don't think I owe that band a penny. Some people may argue that that's not exactly the same thing, and I think that's probably fair, but I don't...
Because it's a physical item.
I don't think it's... Yes, but I also don't think it's entirely dissimilar, because the point is that in both instances, what is going on is somebody other than the original producer of the content is making money off a secondary usage of the content years after the fact. And I think very few people would object to the idea that I have a legal right to sell that LP and that I don't really owe anything to the band in question. In fact, most people would think it was ludicrous that I owe anything to the original band. I completely understand why some people might not say it's exactly the same thing, but I do think it's awfully close to the same thing. And, I get it. These guys were, you know, they live tough lives on the road, and they're destroying their bodies and everything. And I'm very, very sympathetic to that argument. And I wish there was a better system in place for these guys, so that guys didn't die in the prime of their career like Eddie Gilbert, for example, or our guys didn't get, you know, seriously injured and then have no pensions and nothing to go to after the fact. But while I'm sympathetic to why a wrestler who came out of a wrestler's mentality would view compensation here as something that they are entitled to, I don't see a particularly good argument for it.
And I'm not sure, again, this is all as a layperson, I don't know if their specific argument, which is right of privacy, right of publicity, is necessarily going to work here. Doug Summers tried the same thing, and that, you know, very quickly lost him the case because he had been trying to make his name as a famous pro wrestler for years. Part of me feels like and wonders about if there would be some way for a lawyer to try to make a more compelling version of this type of lawsuit, because I don't think this is it. Would you agree with that?
There may be a legal way to do it, but I don't think this is the case to do it with.
Yeah. I'm also a little surprised if Doug is saying then that he never got any royalties for that Royal Rumble. That surprises me.
And then that would be, while not impossible, it would be odd. because the WWE strikes me as a company that generally does a pretty good job covering their bases with things like that, especially in their current form, post-publicly traded company WWE. But then again, I don't know. I mean, they've had a lot of people under contract at various points over the years. You would think post-Jesse Ventura case that, you know, but I mean, you know, the thing about the Ventura case is that that's a whole show unto itself. I mean, I don't even want to get too down that rabbit hole, but that case is an interesting one to discuss and think about in the context of,
but it's not really the same
issue, it's not the same thing, and I think there's probably a lot of people who will make the argument, oh, this is just like the Ventura case. No, it's not the same thing.
So that's kind of why I wanted to talk about it, though, because it seems like a lot of people are getting confused about that already. So the gist is this. Jesse was either renegotiating his contract or negotiating a new contract along with his agent, Barry Bloom, with, I don't know if it was Vince personally, but with Titan Sports, the, you know, former parent, original parent company of Vince McMahon Jr.'s WWF. And they asked about video royalties. And Vince or whoever was doing the negotiating said, well, we pay royalties on videotapes, but only if it is a tape with a featured performer and they are the featured performer on this tape. So Hulk Hogan would get royalties for the Hulkamania videos. Roddy Piper would get royalties for Roddy Piper's Greatest Hits and so on. But nobody else would get royalties for anything. So Jesse and Bloom were like, okay, if that's the deal you have with everyone else, we're okay with that. Let's sign the contract. Eventually, Jesse finds out that I believe Hogan, Mr. T, and Piper, maybe Cyndi Lauper too, basically the type of people you'd think WWE would be trying to take care of, all got royalties for stuff other than being the featured performer on a best of tape. And that was the law. That's what led to the lawsuit. Jesse won, got a big settlement. WWE tried to appeal, failed, and that was what led to Jesse not being used on stuff from old footage, whether being deleted out of it while leaving his partner or dubbing over it outright on some of the budget DVDs and videotapes. And, you know, that even exists with WWE to this day. If Jesse's on something that's coming out on DVD or Blu-ray, they only include him if he's in enough matches on the release that it would become a big problem. So Best of Saturday Night's main event, they kept all his stuff. But if it's something where he's only in one or two matches, they cut him out. So that's what that is. It's because there was a specific deception.
Yes.
I guess someone could try to argue that there was a deception with the other stuff, but not really. But that is why happened.
I think that's what they are trying to do with the claim that they didn't know, or perhaps that's what they're trying to do with the claim that they didn't know that that these were being taped. Or however the verbiage is.
I think it's a being recorded, or I'm guessing they really just meant released on home video or recorded to be released on home video or something like that.
Yeah. Well, that has to be the implication, and my guess is that is going to be sort of the loophole they try and squeeze through. Of course, that's pure speculation from a layman, but, you know, based on what we know...
I don't see how else you could take it. Well, yeah.
No, that seems like their strongest case, and I don't even think that's a particularly strong case, but it's the best leg they have to stand on based on what I know about the filing.
Right. Now, something I don't really understand, I don't know if you will either, but... Okay, WWE isn't paying royalties for the network to current talent because it's covered by their contract. A contract, I believe... I think it started in around 2002. They included something about internet streaming that covered them. For someone who does not have that contract, how is the network different from home video?
I don't think anybody knows the answer to that question. I think that is an open question.
Would you say that is potentially, like, the best avenue for the... you know what I mean? Like, if it's an established... like... again, we're both laymen, but if you just think about it in a common sense, is that seemingly the way that would make the most sense to you? To maybe for them to be able to get something?
I think it is possible that the best attempt will be that their best effort could be centered around the idea that this sort of new medium could never have been envisioned in the old days, and you know, it allows for rapid fire dissemination of all sorts of this stuff, and
it so much more
it expands
of it.
It expands their likeness in a variety of ways. I mean, I think that is, because it really does. I mean, it expands the scope of the likeness, the use of the likeness, rather. In theory, it expands it dramatically, right? I mean, or at least, I shouldn't say that. It expands the accessibility of it dramatically. Does it actually expand it? I don't know. I mean, I think that remains to be seen. I mean, that's one of the things. This is so early on in the network process. But maybe, you know, and in that respect, you might be right. You might be right in the sense that this could be, I hate the term litmus test because I feel like I'm talking about abortion in the Supreme Court. But this could be, you know, sort of the way that let's put it this way. When we heard about the network, the big issue with a lot of people, and CM Punk subsequently talked about this on the podcast, the infamous podcast now with Hulk Hogan, the idea of what cut are we getting out of the network? You know, obviously pay-per-view money is not going to be the same because pay-per-view buy rates are going to plummet because we're deliberately setting up this plan to cannibalize our own market. So how is that going to be calculated? And you never really got an answer. And I still don't know if they have a 100% answer about that. And this could sort of fit into that whole world. So this could be a case where we sort of maybe – at the very least, we kind of get to the bottom of how they're going to deal with that issue going forward, or if they're even going to bother dealing with it at all in the short term. You know, I mean, right. And you know, this ties in, and this is something that we can probably explore on future shows because we got to wrap up pretty soon. But this sort of ties into the notion that an increasingly large number of people are either leaving the WWE or just not taking their deals and not signing. The idea that the WWE is the only game in town, in many ways, of course, it still is, but I think the game has changed in a lot of ways, with a lot, depending on, you know, the scope and size of your profile as a performer, of course. And some of these guys are just sort of saying, to hell with it, and it makes you wonder how much of that has to do with issues like who or what or when are we getting royalties for this network. So all of that could end up being part of this Gilbert family lawsuit at the end of the day.
The last thing I just wanted to touch on for a second before we go is that the Ricky Steamboat lawsuit that got mentioned, that's not really a well-known one, and I've read a little bit about it because WWE filed something from it in the last Martha Hart lawsuit, which has nothing to do with all this for reasons that I won't get into but have been well covered. The Ricky Steamboat thing was basically, he kind of tried to do a Jesse Ventura follow-up lawsuit where his argument was basically he was notified of the royalty scheme as WWE presented it, which is the same way they presented it to Ventura. But he never signed a new contract that agreed to that. The contract he was under from before that is the one he was on through his original WWF run. So he was kind of going based on that for that part of the lawsuit. But I think WWE kind of argued and I think prevailed with, and I haven't reread the whole thing, but this is my memory of most of it, was that he accepted the checks the whole time, etc. He didn't really voice any complaints that the judge found in WWF's favor. And the most interesting thing really about it, though, is that it includes all of his royalties from WWF from, I believe, the second quarter of 1986 through the fourth quarter of 1993, which is interesting to look through. Do you want me to just throw out a random one before we go? Just pull a random royalty payment?
Sure.
Okay, I'll start with a later one just to give an example. So, like, the last one he ever got, or the last one he ever got was for $83.08. For a combination of videos, toys, mail order sales, different things from Canada and domestic throughout 93. And then Did I misread that? No, excuse me, $583.08. I'm not sure I missed that. And then you go back different things, and he made it. But I guess kind of this was from the end of when his last action figure and stuff came out. But, I mean, if you go back, you get how guys in WWF made a lot of money just from merchandise in the 80s. Because he was a guy who, he had an action figure, he had his own video, so he would have made royalties from that. And he was on a lot of, like, do you remember those lunchboxes they had and the stuff like that?
Oh, yeah.
There was a period where he was on a lot of the generic WWF superstars type stuff like that.
Absolutely.
So, just for example, his first ever WWF royalty payment was over $18,500. His next one was over $24,500, $24,600. Lots of stuff into the mid to high four figures. You know, he didn't really, I don't think he had anything five figures after the first few, but you can see how guys made a lot of money just on merchandise back then, and could have even made more if it was, especially I would think with the videotapes, if that whole thing hadn't been as, kind of, what's the best word I can use that's not too judgmental?
I don't know.
I didn't want to say sketchy. I guess sketchy's okay. Sketchy's fair enough, given that they lost a lawsuit over it. Right?
Yeah, we go sketchy.
Yeah. I think, how much more someone like Steamboat could have made if the video part wasn't sketchy. But you get the idea. So I think I'm probably going to talk more about that in Figure 4 this week. Seems like a good topic. And I guess we are done for now, though. So we will try to be back soon. We have a guest we were looking to line up, so that may be what we do next time, right? I don't want to give away who it is yet until we actually do it.
Absolutely. That sounds like a great idea for the mystery guest, which I think people will be excited about. If we can get this locked down, will absolutely be somebody who I think people will be excited to hear us converse with.
On this topic, too. Specifically to this topic.
Absolutely. Absolutely on this topic. This is a very specifically themed show by design. Although we do talk about things that are sort of on the periphery of the theme, we're sticking to this this sort of niche, our niche. I always get into arguments about the appropriate pronunciation of this, but yeah. We're sticking to it either way.
And the mystery guest so far seems really into the idea too. So. Yes, that's it. So yeah, I wanted to try to get under an hour and a half. At least we're just barely over an hour and three quarters. So that's an improvement.
That is an improvement. I literally have to go as soon as possible I have to go deal with issues related to my brother's burned down house. By the way, folks, that's not a joke. That is actually a real thing that happened. So I appreciate anybody who tweets nice thoughtful comments. My family deals with the fallout of my brother losing his home, which really sucks. But in the interim, you can follow me at Dylan Waco, DYLANWACO on Twitter for a lot of smart ass comments. I'm going to be on the Shake Them Ropes podcast after Extreme Rules, sort of giving a rundown and review of that show. And I got some other things lined up. I got a couple ideas for our new episodes of Wrestling Culture that myself and Dave Musgrave do over at PlaceBNation.com. So I've got several things lined up that you can keep an eye out for. Six, what do you got going on here in the next few weeks?
Well, I think we are both going to be on one of the next episodes of Chris Sellner's Exile on Bad Street again within the next week or two. I'm not going to say what the topic is yet. I've got, let's see, Fighting Spirit Magazine, I believe the new one came out, it was last week, right? With two articles for me, one about WWE announcing, one about Ric Flair, who is also coming to the UK for a series of speaking gigs, Q&As, one-man shows, whatever you want to call them, next month. You can read stuff for me on WrestlingObserver.com. I do the daily updates Tuesday, Wednesday, and Saturday. Also have stuff throughout the week on WrestlingInc.com. Some kind of podcast here at davidbix.com every Wednesday at noon. Most weeks, Bix Show trademarks we're trying to do at least once a month. Probably going to settle into about once a month, I think, because that also allows us to make sure we get topics and stuff. And I think I'm free. Oh, and Figure 4 Weekly on Fridays for Figure 4 Online subscriber. Well, /WrestlingObserver.com subscribers. It's the same website, everybody, but you probably know that by now. And, of course, just other stuff, you know, you can check. Just go to my website, I have everything, just about everything relevant linked there. If not, you probably still know where to get it. But davidbix.com has my Amazon links, my ebook links, all that good stuff. So yeah, that is it. And until next week with some kind of big show that I don't think I actually arranged yet, that is it. And and we'll talk to you again then. And I just realized we don't have a theme song we're going to fade out to. We need to find a WWE song that we can chop up like I did for the big show. So Dylan, sing us off. Sing something about intellectual property.
I'm an arse man. Dun.
So long from the Empire State of New York.